Let's have an AA meeting. Can y'all hear me? Hello. My name is Julie and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the Napa Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
I'm Bill Dillon. I'm an alcoholic. This reading is based on passage from page 29 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in the room tonight, listening later on the AA Blue Chip Speakers, desperately in need will hear our speaker and believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Now introduce the speaker and say something positive and keep it short. Damn. I had 15 minutes to prepare, and the whole say something positive about tonight's speaker, it was very difficult. Keep it short was easier. Now, tonight's speaker is a great guy. He has over 2 decades of sobriety, and he's somebody who works very hard at this as a way of life, and he practices these principles in all of his affairs. And tonight's speaker is Mr. Carter.
Hello, everybody. My name is Carter, and I am an alcoholic. It's really amazing, you know, to see this as much as I can see. But anyway, it's really remarkable to have so many miracles in one room. It's something that took a long time for me to really understand. I just get overwhelmed by this because it's just wonderful. My story is not that big a deal because I was born in a small town, Athens, Georgia, back in 1952. My sobriety date, by the way, is March 13th, 1997. And that's a story in itself. But 1952, and I was raised in a very well-to-do family. And I never really had to want for anything. My mother and father really wanted to have me, so it was really a loving family. The initial years of my life, I was a very sickly child. I always had bronchial asthma, bronchitis, strep throat. And back then, the doctors loved to give you codeine, alcohol and codeine, cough syrup. It was given over the counter. But they give me a little bit stronger stuff. And I think I was pretty stoned most of my time in my early years. So I came about this disease pretty naturally. But, you know, along came, I missed most of my first grade years because of it. So I always felt kind of awkward. And coming into my second grade, they sent me to the doctor and we had my tonsils removed. And all of a sudden, something changed. All of a sudden, I got healthy. But I never felt normal ever again. I never felt like I belonged any place whatsoever. And so what I did is I wound up turning to drawing and painting and reading. And we lived out in the country, so it was really nice. I got to go out in the woods a lot and hang with my dog. And it was just what a kid would love. And I enjoyed every bit of it. But I never could feel good about school, and subsequently I wound up getting in a lot of fights and a lot of arguments, and never paid attention to the teachers. And they didn't like me, and that was okay, because I didn't care for them much either. So, I mean, I thought they were a pain in the ass. But, excuse me, I'm not supposed to say words like that up here. But anyway, as I progressed in school, I started realizing that I really loved doing my artwork, and it was something I enjoyed. And I used to draw pictures of animals and people. I had teachers that really, some of them actually liked me because of what I was doing. But they really wanted me to pay more attention in school. But, you know, I was still a shy, quiet person. And I was a very, very big failure at athletics. You know, football, I was horrible. Track, I couldn't run because I always had a short breath. And so I never could fit in being a normal kid and fit in with the rest of the kids. And that seemed like a big athletic school where I went. Along that time, my mother realized that I was a pretty good artist. And she used to sit in front of TV, there was these art shows. And she'd buy me these kits. The school I went to had no art classes whatsoever. So I started following the TV shows, and I was doing okay with it. And the thing that I learned was different skills in this. And that it didn't really matter what people thought. I could live by myself and enjoy that. But I didn't. I was already beginning to lie at that stage of the game. And that's something that an alcoholic likes to do, is lie. I have not met one yet. I love the ones who sit there and say, I'm thoroughly honest all the time. I immediately wonder, you know. And the thing about it is this, is that honesty is one of those things we don't profess, we live. But that, I learned that later on in my life too. But the fact was, is that they finally decided to enter me into some art contests. And the second one I entered into, I won. And I was 15. And it was a full scholarship to the University of Georgia. And Lamar Dodd, who was the head of the department of the University of Georgia, art department, decided that he wanted to take me on. And he did. But I couldn't go to school until I was 16. So what they did, basically, all through my high school years, I didn't really go to high school. I showed up there occasionally, but I was enrolled in high school, but I was also enrolled at the university. And I finished up my college degree at 19, a year after I got my high school diploma. And it was kind of wild because, you know, in college as an art, nobody really paid attention to you. And the professors basically just let me do what I wanted to do as long as I worked and turned in the work. Because they saw that I could do it. And so I felt good about what I was doing. And I didn't feel like I had to belong any longer. I could just be. And along came the fact that some alcohol started showing up. But I really didn't care for that much because my father had become a full-blown alcoholic when I was about 16 years old. And that was another reason why I enjoyed living over in Athens at the university as opposed to living in the town where I grew up in, which was Winder. The fact was that I didn't have to deal with that any longer. And by the time my mother and father got divorced, I was already pretty much on my own. And I could accept that. And I could learn the fact that my father couldn't help what he was doing. But I still didn't care much for alcohol, but there was other substances out there that I really enjoyed. And we're not supposed to discuss that, so I choose to call it substances other than liquor, you know, but the fact was is that I enjoyed them. And it made me feel different. And I'd drink alcohol and I'd automatically become angry. So I kind of stopped drinking. But when I got out of art school, the university, my father says, I don't want any hippie artists. You either go back and become a professional, a lawyer or a doctor or something that made sense, or hit the road, because I'm not going to support this. I hung out and worked in his factory for about 6 months. And then I decided, well, are you going to help me go to a school? He said, oh, yeah, I'll send you any school that you want to if you get a decent degree. And I said, sure, I want to go to Berkeley. And Berkeley was a wonderful school. And my mother's people were from California. So I spent a lot of time in California as well. And the fact was that you could go to school for free back then. All you had to do was come up with your lab fees and stuff if you were a resident. So I went to work at my grandfather's ranch. Well, he didn't like hippies either. I mean, he was a solid, old-fashioned man. He just didn't see anybody running around with long hair. So he immediately put me on this horse, and this horse decided that we weren't going to be friends. The horse decided to throw me about 12 times before we got used to each other. And then they sent me up to the summer pasture in Mariposa to hang out for 3 months until I decided to cut my hair and join the human race or continue to live up there. The nearest road up there was like 20 miles away. And so the only thing I had up there was the horse that didn't really like me and supplies that they brought in every month. Well, my cousin always managed to bring 2 fifths of liquor in there for me, so I was up in that cabin by myself with my beer and my liquor and a little bit of marijuana beer, but you know, we can't talk about those substances here. Anyway, the fact is that my life was already spinning out of control because the fact that I could not create relationships at that time with people. I had trouble with them. I had little bouts of depression as well. And they always wrote it off as because I was creative, which is the biggest bunch of hogwash there ever was. But the fact is that I did have bouts of those. And after 3 months, I came down and cut my hair and went to enroll in Berkeley. And Berkeley was a very fascinating school, but you know, while everybody else was out playing and having a wonderful time protesting and getting into all sorts of other substances, the School of Architecture required that you work. They expected you to be in that lab designing. The professors were very hard. So I came to the point where I had a choice to either study that or drop out. Well, I had a cousin who, in 1966, had dropped out of Stanford. He opened up the first head shop in the Haight. It was called the Psychedelic Tessin. And it was an enormous success for it because everything went on. It was kind of like the center for everything. And he knew all sorts of people, and I got to meet all sorts of people through him. One of the people that I got to meet was Bill Graham, who was running the Fillmore West. And Bill had found out that I was a painter. And so he decided if I could paint, I could probably illustrate his posters for his concerts. And one thing led to another, and I wound up working for some of the most famous artists out there, who, like Mauss and all these other people, just doing inking and whatever, but it was an enormous experience. But the other part is during that time, I wasn't so much involved in... My alcoholism hadn't manifested itself that much yet. What was going on is I was too busy exploring and trying to find other sources of life. I wanted to learn more about spirituality and all sorts of things. And I did. And, you know, the whole key was not a liberal attitude, was so much we just didn't want the government to mess with us. We wanted to be able to live our own lives. And that's where it came from, most of my thinking. I wanted to be left alone, which was a typical alcoholic. I didn't want anybody telling me what to do, anti-authority. But, you know, one of the things that I got to do is I got to experience other people and their parties and all sorts of things. And, of course, I got involved in drinking and drugs and everything else. But after so many years, my painting started taking off, and I became a painter, full-fledged. And I started painting on the West Coast a lot, selling paintings. I thought they were a big deal. You know, $500 to $1,000 was a lot of money to someone like me. It wasn't that much to a lot of people, but I had a lot of pretty well-to-do people that I had met through the rock scene and things like that. They were buying my art. Big computer people, all sorts of people were involved with buying stuff that I was producing. And I started thinking I was somebody. And of course, with coming thinking that I'm somebody, comes drinking, comes ego problems. And the more I drank, the worse my pains got. So finally, I pretty much burned myself out on drinking. But I also burned myself out on art. In about 74, my father calls me. And he says, you know, my father never called me, ever. He called me up and said, you know, I need to see you and you need to come home. And I said, okay. And I did. Because I knew something was wrong. And I got home and I found out that his alcoholism had caused him to have diabetes and created a heart attack. And he was just hanging in there at that time. And it bothered me a lot. And, you know, he said to me, you know, Carter, I'm making a deal right now. I'm going to give up alcohol. But what I'm going to do is give it up January 1st, and this is October. And I'm just going to drink beer. I'm not going to drink any hard liquor anymore. I'm going to start trying to behave, and I'm going to start give up the factories and go to work doing something I really like for a change. I said, Dad, you can't make deals with that. And I had had enough experience with the disease and things to know that if you think you need to give up at that moment, you need to stop. Because that's the first sign of anything. And it was with me. But he didn't. And so what happened was this. Along came January 1st, and I get a phone call from one of his girlfriends. He didn't show up. And I said, well, you know, Dad, he could have been out partying or doing something else. So I went to find him. And I first went to the country club. And yes, he had showed up there, and he left about 8:30, 9 o'clock. Started to get pretty drunk. Then I went to his after-hours bar that he liked to hang out at. Yeah, he was there till about midnight, and he left. So I couldn't figure out where he might be, so I decided to go over to his house. So we drove all the way back to Winder. And I thought, well, maybe you put the car in the lake, because we had a lake right in front of the house, and it was like a curved driveway that was a curve. And I went past the lake, and there was no sign of the car. He did that periodically. My father was pretty wild. I mean, he had girlfriends. He and I got into a fight one time over at a restaurant called Cleves over the waitress who was going to be able to take her home. We were both pretty drunk. But, you know, that was insanity that I was already beginning to have. But when, you know, the fact is I got home, and I got over to his house, and his car was parked there, and I knew something was wrong. So he wouldn't answer the door, so I went to where the key was stashed, and I walked in there, and he was dead. Alcohol had killed him. He'd been dead for about 4 or 5 hours. He had his Johnny Walker Black sitting there. Dog was howling. And I called up my grandmother and told him Dad had passed away, and then immediately started cleaning up his stuff. I had to hide his pot. I had to hide his booze. I had to hide his porno and everything else, and before anybody got there. They all got there, and then the doctors decided to do an autopsy on him. Sure enough, he died at January 1st. He quit drinking. January, like he said he would. And I always thought about that. You know, the fact is that you can't make deals with this disease. Because nobody gets out alive. But did that stop me from drinking? No, it manifested my drinking. All of a sudden, I went over the edge. And I started drinking, and I went on a 5-year party from that point on. And the fact is that when you start giving an alcoholic who thinks he's some kind of big shot a lot of money, that's a dangerous combination for people like me. It's like just, you know, giving me an unlimited credit card that I could have anything I wanted. And I did. And I proceeded to stay drunk. My sister and I would do outrageous things. We rented a floor at Peachtree Plaza for a New Year's party. Invited everybody to come. Booze flowing everywhere. We'd have major parties and stuff like that. And we didn't have that kind of money. but our brains thought we did. We weren't doing anything to achieve anything in life. We were living off inheritance. And what do you do? That's too much time when you have that. You just drink. You drink and you find pretty soon you get that gets old and you start hating yourself. Pretty soon you start hating everybody around you. And that's what happened to me. So finally, there wasn't anything out there that would make me happy any longer. I would try trips. I would do anything. I'd do anything to find something, some peace, some happiness. And then I all really fell down on my head. It was 1982. It was March 22nd. Remember, my birthday is March 13th, but March 22nd. I decided to get drunk, and I wound up at a place called some place in Athens. It was called Papa Joe's, and I began to drink there. And they pretty much let me drink till 12 midnight. And they said, "You got to leave." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because we're closing. You've got to go." And I got angry, and I got in my car, and I went over to the bar down the street that was still open, and I proceeded to drink. Well, they weren't happy with me in there, and they didn't want to serve me anything because I was drunk. And I proceeded to get really mad at that point. And I got very angry at the bartender who kept insisting. He knew me, and he kept, tried to be nice about it, but it didn't look that way to me. I thought he was just picking on me. And I said, "Okay, if you're not going to serve me anything to drink, nobody in this bar needs to be drinking." And I picked up a bar stool and proceeded to knock over a bottle in the back of the bar and crash it. Threatened the bartender with his life. He ran to get the owner. And I was out there getting into an argument with somebody else in the floor, main floor, and proceeding to throw a chair through the plate glass window of the front door as the cops came through. Now, the remarkable thing about this is the way my life had been blessed at that time, the cops proceeded to put me in a car and send me home. And I got to go home that night. And I woke up the next day and I couldn't find my car. I couldn't find anything. And the cops, I called my mother. My mother didn't know anything about what happened. She told me that I was, called her up and I was being a drunken jerk. So I proceeded to just, call up the taxi cab company. The taxi cab company proceeded to tell me under no circumstances would they ever pick me up, take me anywhere again. And that my car was at this bar. And so I got somebody to carry me to that bar. And I get walked in there, and the owner looked at me and says, "Carter, I'm a drunk, but you got a real problem. And if you will promise to go do something about yourself, I won't press charges about anything." Well, I called AA that afternoon immediately, and I had a good friend of mine come over there, and I had to shake so bad. Well, he sat with me through it. His name was Gip P. He's dead now. He was a wonderful man. He later went on to be my sponsor for a while until he couldn't put up with me any longer. But I sat there, and I went in that night and picked up a white chip. And, of course, I was so full of it. And I proceeded to stay in the program for 11 years, but I never worked a real program during that 11 years. I socialized a lot. I hung out a lot. I mouthed the right things a lot. I didn't work a real program. I had no understanding of God. I thought it was all up to me. And the biggest problem I had my first year in the program was, was God going to be able to afford a BMW? Come on. Most people have some real problems. But during that period of time, I didn't. I was too busy thinking about me. And that proceeded to go on. So about the third year, I got bored with the program and I started coming and going. And that proceeded to be my pattern as I grew in the program for the next 11 years. And then I decided I'd get married. Getting married is just a wonderful thing for somebody who has no program, who's a dry drunk. But I knew it would fix me. I'd find what I needed. That poor woman didn't know what she saw. She was a wonderful woman. We were together for about a good 8 years. And we moved to St. Simon's, and I was working in development. And I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing, which was painting. I was doing everything else because I wanted to be somebody. I wanted money, power, and prestige. Everything that the program said was dangerous for someone like me. But that's what I wanted. I was too busy trying to compare myself to other people. Where does the real program come into that? And where does God fit into that when I'm too busy doing it on my own? There is no God. I haven't seen him. So subsequently, about 9 years into that program, I started feeling empty all the time. Same emptiness I had when I came into the program. Because I was on a dry drunk. And so I decided to go see a psychiatrist. And I found a real good psychiatrist. He's the one who told me I had emotional issues. And I probably wasn't a real alcoholic. Here, take some of these pills. Oh yeah, that's the ticket. Take some of these pills, you know. Along comes 11 years into the program. And I'm ready for it. There wasn't any six-pack that magically appeared in my lap, in my hands. I was in my car, and I just walked into the package store, picked up a six-pack, and headed for Mobile. What I was going to do in Mobile, I had no idea, but I was beginning a four-year rampage, and that's what I did. When people say that this is a progressive disease, it is every bit a progressive disease because I'm a full example of it. I never had problems with any kind of police institutions, nothing. I wound up going to jail. I wound up going into institutions. And this happened within months of me taking that first drink. Not years. I wound up full-fledged drunk within months. I lost everything I had within months. I was a terror within months. Nobody wanted me anymore within months. I had to move constantly because I was always looking behind my over my shoulder to see who was after me. That went on for 4 years until finally somebody at the end of that little rage that I went on that binge decided that he was going to help me. He decided he was going to put me to work for the Olympics. And Bill Payne asked me to do the trailings on the graphics for the Olympics, and I did. And I was sitting in a house when the bottom fell up out of the money in the Olympics, because that's what happens to practicing alcoholics. It's always a problem. It's always somebody else's fault. It's always a loss. It's always this. And it's always me, everybody but me. And that's what happened. I was behind on my mortgage. Everything was gone. And I proceeded to go to the righteous room and get drunk. And I was sitting in the righteous room, and you know when you have that sickly feeling where you drank yourself without living for too long? You have that greasy feeling you can't wash, take a shower, get it off. You know, where you just, you can't get drunk, you can't get sober. You're just sitting there miserable. You haven't got a decent thought in your mind. You're just in that perpetuating misery and anger. That's where I was. And the first thing I thought of, hey, maybe if I got some pot, maybe that'll help me get really screwed up, get out of myself. So I asked the bartender. He says, oh, sure, I'll get you some pot. It's $40. Well, I still happen to have 50 still on me. That was the last 50 I had, but typical alcoholic, I didn't care. I wasn't worried about money. I was drunk. And you know what? he brought this little thing in to me and showed me, and he said it was still $40. And I said, no. I'll just get myself drunker. And I spent the rest of the money on getting drunk to where I was down to nothing. And I remember picking up my last drink, which was Pete's Wicked Ale. I bought a big shot at Winn-Dixie. I probably could buy a cheaper beer and gotten a couple of them, but I just got that one because that was a big shot. And stumbled back to my house on Greenwood in Frederica. And I sat there. And I mean, I was ready to go. I was ready to end it all. But something told me to call a friend in that program. And I kept fighting and arguing with that in my mind. Till finally I did. I picked up the phone. And you know, I called that guy and he came over and he sat with me. He brought this little dog and that little dog kept running around. I don't know if it was real or not because I had DT so bad. And I was into that, you know, that far out situation that, you know, my mind was really across the universe because I was already going through withdrawals, but that dog was running. I mean, it was just amazing. And he was talking to me about sobriety. We sat there until daybreak, and then he said, let's go get some coffee, and we stumbled down St. Charles to a place called Caribou, and I sat in Caribou, and I remember I had a cup of coffee in my hand, but I was shaking so bad I couldn't hold the coffee, you know. It was like all over my hand, everywhere, and I was just shaking. I kept trying to get that down, and he got me another one. And it was like time just flew. And all of a sudden he says, you ready to go? I said, where to? I mean, like I was so popular, I had a lot of places to go now. I had drank myself into oblivion. He says, we're going to go down the street. I said, okay, let's go. And so I stumble down there. He's walking normal. And we get to a place. It was a 12 noon, high noon group. But I didn't know it was the high noon. All I remember was a red door right there, and this was upstairs. And he stopped at the door, and he says, you're going to have to go in and make a choice. I said, where am I going? He says, you're going into AA. He said you were interested in getting sober. You make that choice. I've got to go. So I went in there, and I sat down. Now, I'd been in AA meetings before, so it wasn't unusual. And I sat there, but for this time, nothing made sense at all. Now, my brain usually worked pretty good, but this time it just absolutely did not make sense. Nothing did. No one made sense that we're talking. I know they were fine, but to me, nothing was working. Except one phrase came across to me, but was I willing to go to any length? And I hit home. It was like something that pierced me, something that made some real firm words into my mind. Was I willing to go to any length? And along came the time to pick up chips. But it was kind of hard. My ego says, you know, you've had 11 years. You don't need to pick up a white chip. I had to pick up a white chip, and I did. And everybody was talking to me and all this other stuff. And the funny thing is all of a sudden I felt a little sober. I felt like I got a little clarity in my mind. They asked me, did I need work? I needed money. So they immediately got me a job working with a paint company, and I was working that afternoon. God knows they had to deal with me, but I tried. I tried. And I kept going back. And I kept listening. And I told them my story, and they said, we don't want to listen to your story. We don't want to listen to you right now at all. If you want to, you need to be listening to us. And that's the hardcore people in the program. They said, they made me listen. Because they told me I was full of bullshit all the time. And I was. I was totally full of bullshit. And they said, you know, every time I open up my mouth, they'd say, you're just a lie and quit it. So I just, more and more, I just stopped. I learned several things, that I needed to get up in the morning, go to work. I needed to go to AA. I needed to eat. I learned to function. I started living on couches. I was homeless. I had to learn to get rid of my pride and ego. I went from being somebody of a man of promise to a man full of promises. And I was so far removed from who I was and what I was doing. But I had to stay sober. And I wanted to stay sober for me, because I knew what the alternative was. I didn't care about gaining anything. I just wanted a better way of living. Paying my bills, having a roof over my head, food to eat. I didn't care about all the big stuff. I didn't give a rat's ass about any Mercedes Benz or anything like that. I just wanted to be able to take care of myself. And that's what I did. And I kept trying that. But you know, during that 4 years that I had that problem of drinking continuously on my sabbatical, or whatever you want to call it, one of the situations I ran into is I was working for an investment company, and I got into some serious trouble with the law. Like, we were sitting in the office, and in walks the Attorney General and the SEC and a lot of other people that ripped off a lot of money from a lot of people out there in investments. And they asked me what my position in this matter was, and I told them I wasn't involved. I was just working for them. The partners had taken off with like $40 million and disappeared. I didn't know anything about that. Well, 5 years into the program, I was arrested, and I had to go sit in jail about investments. And the fact was, is I had to sit in there for 256 days. 90 days in solitary, where I wasn't allowed to get into general population because they were afraid I'd make phone calls and make communication. So I had to sit in there. But you know, the way it kept me going is I had a 12-step program that kept me thinking. I kept turning my will and my life over to the care of God. And I kept letting go. And it was not that hard. So finally I got to that point where the attorney general, this assistant DA, said, "We got to cut this boy. I mean, I don't have anything to charge him with." And the judge said, "Well, we got to cut him loose." She said, "I can't cut him loose. He's got some criminal charges that we're trying to get." He said, "If you haven't got him by now, you aren't going to." So she comes marching out to me and she says, "I'm going to OR you." And I said, "No, I want a speedy trial. I want this over with." She says, "No, I'm ORing." I said, "No." My attorney's flabbergasted, and she said, "I have this check." Well, the check hadn't been endorsed. It hadn't been deposited. I didn't know anything about it. You see, this was God working, and they cut me loose. But the fact is, I wanted to stay sober. And I got out and immediately headed to a meeting. And I continuously stayed in meetings, because I had nothing and I had to start all over again, and I knew if I stayed sober, I could make it. And it always worked. But I still had to go through a lot of things. But the fact is that I still didn't have a real good concept of a program. I still was just talking the program. I wasn't really working it. I still didn't really use the sponsor like I was supposed to. And I really wasn't working with others, but I knew everything still. And that's no program. Because you see, a drunk loves everything. You see tons of them sitting on a bar stool. They know everything. And they always live in the past. And that was two things I learned. To become sober, I had to get out of the past, and I had to actually shut up and learn something. And I had to learn how to work the steps. Along came 2010, and I came down with cancer. And I was starting to do my work again of being a painter. And that wiped me out. I had cancer all over my jaw and to my brain. And I basically was scary as anything I could ever believe. The doctors told me I was going to become semi-vegetable. And the thing about it is I kept coming to meetings and I kept working the program. And the thing that I realized at this time that the 12 steps were the only thing that was going to get me through, and it was going to get me through a lot. So what I had to really learn, and then I lost my sight, and that was even scarier. But during that time, it was probably the best time that I've ever really worked a program and worked the 12 steps. Because the first step I learned is that I couldn't get along with people, and I had to learn to realize that I was truly powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. The second step, I had to realize what insanity was. Insanity is the fear and anger that govern me. And when I can make peace with God, I no longer have to live in fear and insanity. And then I realized what turning my will and my life over to care of God is. It's not just part of it, it's the whole part of me. It's not just my disease, it's every bit of me. And let God take control and take over my life. The fourth step, I actually got down and started understanding what was all about. That nobody was really out there threatening me. And I basically, everything was self-inflicted and self-induced. The fifth step allowed me to be able to talk to people freely and open up and share my experience, strength, and hope. And also my fears and anger, and find out about why I had that and what was causing them. And then going on to making amends, that was an easier part. Because all I had to do was show up and make amends when it was time and not have to worry about what the consequences were. I had already faced most of the consequences in my life of jail and whatever. The 11th step, though, became a real strong step for me, because every morning I pray for God's knowledge and will and ask for the strength to carry it out. Thy will, not mine, be done. And I sit there in a quiet state, and I listen. And you know, God always sends me guidance through something I can't always accept. And today with my life, I have a wonderful, amazing life. I'm doing a craft that is unbelievable. I paint. I'm selling painting. I've had shows. I get to know people. I've met people that were turned against me. And you know, it's all because of the 12-step program. I'm a blind man. I have all but 10% of my vision, but I'm able to paint. Now, if that isn't God, I don't know what is. And the truth is this. When I realize what the miracle is, of two people can keep a person sober, then I realized that nothing else could ever make somebody sober except the two people in the program sharing their experience, strength, and hope. When I realized the 12 steps helped make this work instead of me trying to make it work, and when I start seeing all of these wonderful miracles, and when I learn to live in gratitude, stay constantly grateful, then I'm actually able to be sober. And sober to me means clarity of mind. I don't have to worry about anything any longer. It just happens today because I'm allowing it to. Instead of me fighting, I quit fighting everything and everybody. This program is a wonderful program. Y'all taught me well. Thank you for my sobriety.
Thank you, Carter. I've known you a long time, and now I feel like I actually really know you, and I really was moved by your story. I've asked Lauren to come up and give out the chip.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Lauren. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lauren.
Carter, thank you so much for your story. Here at the 8 o'clock Blue Chip Speaker on Monday nights, we have a chip system to mark our time in sobriety. The white chip is something we offer for the first time for coming in or coming back. So anyone who would like to start our way of life for one day at a time, you'll need a white chip. Or if you're coming back. All right. So, does anyone else need a white chip tonight? All right. For 30 days, we have a silver chip. 30 days in a row of sobriety. Anyone need silver chip? Red chip marks the 90 days of sobriety, 3 months. Anyone need a red chip tonight? Yellow chip for 6 months of sobriety. Going twice. Does anyone have 9 months of sobriety? Okay, when the grass turns green on the way back to the liquor store. Alright, I'm not going to try. Alright, we have a blue chip to mark 1 year or multiple thereof. Yay!
Hey, my name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And this is 19 years. And very proud to call this my AA home group. I've really enjoyed this meeting quite a bit. It's kept me sober for the past 10 years or so, I think, right? Yeah. But anyway, I continue to do this stuff that was recommended to me in the very beginning. I go to a ton of meetings. I've got a sponsor, and I sponsor people. I work the steps in all affairs of my life. I work with others, and I've learned to pray, and I have fun in recovery, and that works for me. And Carter, that was a great story. Your imagination has been fired, just like the big book things. And I'm somebody who also has to try to come up with some imagination, and I thought that the drugs and alcohol would do that for me, and it just didn't work. It made me very unimaginative and lazy and pretty much a slob. But I know that you know that this program has given me imagination and so many other things. And to me, AA delivers everything that alcohol and drugs promised but failed to deliver. Thank you for my sobriety.
Congratulations. Does anyone else need a blue chip?
Surprise!
Oh, yay! Oh, good!
Thank you, Lauren. I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. This marks 11 years. And if you know my sister, when you see her here, she's an Al-Anon. It's usually when I'm picking up the chip. Not always, but so far she hasn't missed one. And this is my opportunity to thank her, because she's the one that I asked for help. I never asked for help before. And without any hesitation, she said, "I know what we're going to do." And we were 65 miles away. And she told me to pack a bag. I thought I was going to rehab, but she brought me to NAMBA and enrolled me into the University of Alcoholism Recovery. And my very first meeting was here, where I picked up a white chip. And the speaker that night was a friend of ours from high school, and it was the little brother of my high school girlfriend. He was also my best customer. He was 12, I was 16. And I kept him and his buddies looped in the treehouse, the neighborhood treehouse. And he financed my romance. And he was sober 12 years, standing here telling his story. Boy, I never would imagine it worked out like that. I picked up that white chip. Pam stood by my side and helped me. Get started. Some tough love and some soft love. It was good. And so our family has done a lot of healing. I'm grateful. And the good news today is my oncologist told me that he is going to set me free. And that 7.5 years of cancer treatments and such, he said, I might get cancer again, but that cancer is gone. Right. And Carter, thank you. Thank you so much. That was really... I've heard a lot of your stories over the years. We worked down in the dining room downstairs together a lot. Did a lot of activities, events. I've heard a lot of them, but I've never heard the whole saga, and it was really, really rewarding for me to have you here tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And finally, we offer a white chip one more time. Does anyone need a white chip tonight? Everyone deserves a second chance. All right. Thank God for the chips you hold.
Thank you, Lauren. Congratulations, everybody. The very first announcement I'm going to make is that Kelly's been back there putting together a cake for these guys, so don't leave without your piece of cake. Just let the celebrants get one first, since he's already rubbing his hands together. So you better, he'll probably trip you on the way there, so be careful.
On that broad highway.